start the discussion now. And I think just to focus it a second, I'll read what the statement that was made at the beginning, the credits, and then at the end, and then read the words of the song, the one song that was in the movie, and then just let's open it up. At the beginning, you remember as the screen was filled with a picture of what's called the Gene and his father in an informal, semi-affectionate pose. That's how they describe the author describes the picture. And Gene has a voiceover and he says, "Death ends a life, but it does not end a relationship, which struggles on in the survivor's mind towards some resolution which it may never find. Which it may never find." And at the end of the movie, "Death ends a life, but it does not end a relationship, which struggles on in the survivor's mind towards some resolution which it never finds. Alice said, I would not accept the sadness of this world. What did it matter if I never loved him or he never loved me? Perhaps she was right, but still, when I hear the word father, it matters." If each of us could find a way to feed the young the words we say, to touch each other openly, to feel that we are more than strangers, that's where love may be. And anybody have anything to say about the movie? Must have, you're here. I don't want to... impose feelings I have on the movie unnaturally. I'll impose them naturally as time as conversation begins, but I don't want to start out that way.
One thing I found is reading Save from Wednesday today and parliamentary spirit which you talked about. Mm-hmm. One part says, "Man is at the top of society, covered with honors and university degrees, entrusted with important tasks in the church and in the government. But his son sees his father every day at home in an altogether different light, pulsed with violent affair. The father manages to evade his son's questions by treating him as a teacher, by remaining upon his pedestal of paternal and social authority. The very contrast between the brilliant social personage and the mean person he really is scars the simple child's soul and plunges him into neurosis."
Okay.
I thought that was really cool.
Would you like to hear that again?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Real, very loud.
"A man is
loudly
at the top of society, covered with honors and university degrees, entrusted with important tasks in the church and in the government. Like his father was like the mayor he mentioned and had a school board and stuff. But his son sees his father every day at home in an altogether different light, impulsive, violent, unfair. The father manages to evade his son's questions by treating him as impertinent, by remaining upon his pedestal of paternal and social authority. The very contrast between the brilliant social personage and the mean person he really is scars the simple child's soul and plunges him into neurosis." I thought that sounded like
Yeah.
His dad was always everybody out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that a natural conflict that would be between a son and a father almost no matter what the father did? I mean, you'd like your particular, your dad's a minister, and you'd see certain clashes in what he does and the way you see him. Are there other father son other things that fathers would do that would also have that, or is it dependent on the minister is in a sort of a high position, at least in many people's eyes in terms of righteousness. And I think there are old jokes about preacher's kids that, you know, they're either devils or angels. They end up either devils or angels. And in the movie, and in the case that Tim brought up, which is a, you know, reads like it comes, could have been something that the actors should read in understanding the plot of this movie. He was in a high position too, mayor of the town and so forth. But is it something that say a laborer might have with his son, that same difficulty? Are we talking about something that's particular to this guy and his position in society, or are we talking about something that could happen very easily anywhere?
Doesn't that have something to do with interacting with social acquaintances, where the interaction is always kept to be very smooth and very nice, and then the daily throwing the dollars back at home?
Yeah. I think that could work in almost any father-son situation. At least that's my take on it. And would it work also in the son? Son's at school, then comes home. I think what Tournier said, and we have to keep Tournier, that there are parallels, but Tournier wasn't referring to the characters as we saw them in the movie, saying what we heard them say and doing what we saw them do. So that the parallels are striking, but it isn't the same situation. I don't think we can quite so easily say, I mean, he uses the word, what, just plain mean and sort of vile person, and I think we have to do some, before we could say that about Tom Garrison, we'd have to talk about it a little bit. But Tournier is saying that the difference in the in that particular case, the man was considered to be quite a personage, you know, and that's a good word, a very laudable man by everyone who knew him in his job. But when he came home, he became a different person. And we'll have to take Tournier at his word that he was, Tournier says, the real fellow was mean and nasty, and that he was only playing a role while he was outside the home. Tournier's quote says it was a lie, everything out there was a lie, and when the guy was at home, he was his real self and a mean person. He uses the word real self for the mean. Now, I don't think we can make that judgment yet on Tom Garrison. But this clash between what the child is informed by the parents and by other people that their parents are, and the picture they get of them outside the home and the picture that they get of them inside the home, and many times there's a big clash. And I think that's pretty well anywhere. I mean, you would have different, a friend of mine in high school, his father was a real tough guy, you know, a real tough guy. And then he finds out his father's a coward, you know. And that was a real clash, you know, real clash. A father talked very tough and yet was, you know, sort of like Rip Van Winkle chased around, you know, chased around the house with a broom. And there were real clashes there. So I think clashes like that can happen almost in any father and son relationship, no matter what the father does. Even if no one in the world is lauding the father, the father, the son will get a picture of the father of some really good things. Usually someone will be saying, he's a remarkable man. And sometimes the father will say that about himself, or want that, and to be known.
I think the same thing happens though for the child in the school life. I think it gets more, I think sometimes differences as a child formulates his personality more in outside of the home, in school, in college, that there is a great deal of difference in their two lives. And there'll be a real distinction as to the child at home and the child away at school during the day. And so that the home life is it's a whole different way of, I mean, the whole content of conversation changes at home. And so I think looking at the parent in the working situation, I think that there are parallels running in the child too. So that the home life is really is a different place than where you spend the day.
And that in some ways the children too are meaner, are when they come home, and more common in terms of their corny complaints, you know, as the, say the father, you know, was this great mayor, but he came home and he was corny and he complained and he things, but maybe the child has corny complaints too, but we're not that aware of them. Is that something that we can go with? I mean, as something that, you know, bothered both the children in this were that he was always doing something. And could the parents also see that the children were always doing something? Well, you're always doing this or that.
I think that's a very valid point. But I also think that as parents, we very often contribute to the unfortunate situation by pretending that we're better than we really are, being unwilling to admit, you know, that we have weaknesses and shortcomings and failures and the like.
Yeah. I'm glad you're here. How easy is it to give up the adulation of 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 year old children? I don't know how conscious that kind of thing would be, but
I think there is a time when children kind of grow up, when they realize that their parents aren't perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see it coming that early.
Mm-hmm.
I see the lack of that, the adulation feeling later in life.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, after we get into our 20s, like my daughter told me, year or so ago, that while I always felt that we were close, you know, father and daughter, she didn't feel that way at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was quite a blow.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I learned one incident in my life and ministry that really turned her off to me.
Mm-hmm.
A comparatively small thing.
Yeah.
But she held on to that, and that it really disrupted our relationship.
And did she inform you of that?
Not at the time,
yeah.
Not until 5 years later. Mm-hmm. And then we talked about it, and then she admitted that she had been unfair.
Yeah.
And asked for forgiveness.
Yeah.
But not only what you do either, it's sometimes what people make of it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Maybe it
How well is one capable of functioning under the kind of scrutiny and that, say, children, I think a period, say, 14 to 21, say, can give their parents? And does the parent always know that that scrutiny is being given? I mean, like you said on this thing, it was a small thing that was meant so much. Okay, is that kind of scrutiny given? Parents during a period, say, 14 to 21? Do the parents know about it? Would it make a difference if the parents were aware of it? Although, we tend to sympathize with the younger, is the kind of scrutiny that at least I gave my parents during that period at best unfair, at worst vicious? When that happened, what would be done? Conclusions were made.
Sometimes I was told that it was just pointed out to me exactly what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I just got a very cool look after you realized that you're making this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was generally the case. I mm-hmm. wanted to see how strong they were.
Mm-hmm.
How much I could trust them to listen. How much time did they give me?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when they, if there was something brewing that was bothering them, I just wanted their attention.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily to confess something, but just that they were listening.
Yeah. Was that kind of a heads I win, tails you lose proposition?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, could they ever win?
Oh, no, I had to be the victim.
Yeah.
15, 17, 18.
Yeah. But I guess what I particularly meant in terms of asking to see how far they would go, was it heads I win, tails you lose? Could they ever go far enough before they lost patience and shut it off? And then, if they did that, would there be were there conclusions drawn in regard to the parent?
I don't think I could realize really that at that time that they were my parents, and they were people that were in a situation where I'd be. I didn't mm-hmm. realize that I was. I guess maybe I was trying to fashion myself. Doing mm-hmm. seeing what a parent does,
mm-hmm.
handles the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And unknowingly, maybe I was trying to put myself in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Which was pretty selfish. Selfish maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But if I couldn't get just the conversation on a topic sometimes, it was really, parish household is usually pretty busy.
Mm-hmm.
And if I couldn't get it, I'd just chat. And I was too big-headed to show a weakness if something was wrong. And the other alternative was an argument.
Mm-hmm.
I'd pick out something that I could complain about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parents.
We're talking about different ages, and some Sig brought that up, that there was an older age, you know, that the I had asked the question is how easy is it to, and I think it can be so it doesn't have to be conscious, don't think it would be conscious, but how easy is it for a parent to let go of the idea that the child has of them that they develop in the first, and I said 7 years, but it could continue up to maybe 14 years. And these are not altogether arbitrary figures. But not the same in everybody. But how easy is it to let go of that image that the child has of you? And then during the years 14 to say 21, how aware are the parents of the degree of scrutiny that children have and at times exert on them? How aware are the parents? And if parents are being scrutinized and measured, against what measure are they, you know, against what scale are they being measured? Is it a valid one, or is it a scale developed maybe in the first 7 years when you were 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 feet tall? Yeah.
Well,
that's a lot of questions, by the way.
We're here just as guests.
Don't ever say just as guests at home. Break both your legs. Okay, go ahead.
Two of my sons are sitting here.
Okay.
There's, you know, several things that come to mind. Having been in this parent business for 25 years, I don't really speak from anything else than just that experience, but I ran into a formula one time in some place where, well, if you have, say, you know, 10 people sitting around a table, if you have 2 people, well, you have, you know, maybe you've heard this formula, you have a 1-to-1 interreaction. If you have 3 people, why it's 9, and
mm-hmm.
whatever it is. And the formula works out the number of people to, or n to that power minus 2 or something. Anyway, there's a little over 1,000. By the time you get 10 people around like this, since we're all interacting with it, then, so it gets pretty heavy, I mean, as far as the, you know, you lose that 1-to-1 thing right away. And then you're a different parent to every child in every year.
Mm-hmm.
And then our ideas range and mine change from year to year as we grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what I'm saying is that maybe, you know, we just have to look at it that way, that we just have to, this first time we were in parents, and we can't just read in a book how we're going to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just kind of let the family mold us, in a sense, and you know, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm hearing over here is, you know, is that what are, you know, are the kids trying to set the parents up to act a certain way, maybe Jim here this morning, but, no, like, this is the point, we just got back from Israel here a while back, and life over there is just, it's very verbal, and families are yelling at one another. And, you know, there isn't any physical violence, but they're very verbose and vocal. And like a friend of mine who's Jewish, I went to his place for dinner one night, and I'd never heard such yelling and at the kids. And it, between he and his wife, you know. And I thought, my gosh, maybe, you know, Dan should have called and told him I was coming home for dinner. I thought maybe this would upset the wife. You know.
Yeah.
And I just got really uncomfortable just sitting there, and just, there was just this carrying on, you know, and we got in the car to go to the meeting after dinner. And I said, Dan, you know, maybe I should not come tonight. I hate to cause a problem for the meeting. And he said, what problem? I said, you know, they argued me. Argumentative. We weren't arguing. He said we haven't argued since we've been married. The little kid, he calls not double up, you're triple up, you little devil, you know. Get up here, Anna. But, you know, underneath all those words, there's this basic feeling of love and care, mm-hmm. and even though it's maybe negative, it's mm-hmm. hit him with love.
Yeah.
And so, we kind of think we want to tune in with what we say and communicate to our kids, but somehow I think that we all know just how each other feels most of the time, even though we don't communicate. Now that movie last night, it was just tremendous acting, and I couldn't help but think about the father, you know, who carried all that hostility and hate through life, and then he projected that, and then what did his son, you know, it'd be interesting to know what concept his son had of God. You know, if you take that from the father, when you're little, well, maybe he didn't have a very good concept of God, and maybe that's what was part of his problem, because he couldn't, you know, he couldn't supplement. He was looking for love from his father, and he wanted to get that kind of straightened around before he could get right with God. But possibly, you know, if it had that the Christian dimension in that show last night,
yeah,
then that would have been the solution,
yeah,
for him.
I think very clearly that's a picture of lives outside of Christ,
yeah.
And I think that's where almost we have to keep it, and it's very hard to do that sometimes.
Yeah.
But to keep discussing. Life outside of Christ, and as it is, you know, because I certainly see that there's an awful lot of gospel places where the gospel would stick in that movie. Very important places, and I think what almost has to be talked about is what that looks like, because it's, I think, part of that relationship is true of everybody as old Adams, you know, as by nature, outside of Christ, there are moments of that kind of difficulty, if not to the tremendous degree that it was in that movie, and I think probably very few cases where it was any of our lives here were without the blessing of the gospel on us, to the point where that was as bad, you know, our lives are as bad as it seemed there. But a lot of that is to, you know, a lot of the conversation to look at natural things, you know, our bents and leanings and so forth, because I certainly see that, you know, Well, in a priesthood, what, 9 sons?
8.
You better be a Christian. that Christ really has to, in the gospel, has to get in there, you know. And I think many people are, many times there is a difference. The gospel does make a difference. Christ does make a difference. And we're not to, we aren't, as some psychologists would have us, unmoored. There is no alternative. This is the way things are. But I think tonight they sort of talking about this is the way things are in the natural world. And then to get some more specific things, because you were talking, what you were saying is about a recognition of weakness, and in terms of you can't be righteous and because of the numbers of relationships are past human comprehension that are going on, and you can't do it. And that kind of understanding would be very important to any parent-child relationship. But
Tom,
yeah,
I think that my reaction to that is, sounds good from within, but that doesn't really work when we're not Christianity. I mean, maybe that's what you're trying to say, but I look at that and try and put that in my own family. Having non-Christian parents, that speaks to that. And what you're saying, I think, is you can't put Christian values on that. You can't discuss it with your Christian, because it's not.
You can't separate it completely, but you can more rather than less. And I think, and I think I can't separate myself from it, just like you're finding maybe. I can't separate that myself from it, because I'm not, as far as I know, there's been one Christian, and I've related to my father. Even though I was going to the church in a way that was far outside of Christ, at different times. And I'm sure, and as a parent already to my children, and the oldest, it's 3, I've related outside of, I've related as being only of the world, in and of the world. And I've done it enough to be able to talk about that as that's... That's my story.
Sean?
Wait, just a second. First on Anne, does that speak to what you said or not? Or not being able to separate? Without talking, outside of Christ, I don't see there's any hope.
It's almost judgmental to come back and judge us. What I'm going through, I think, is to be able to discuss with them on a basis, where do you start from?
Mm-hmm.
How do you start talking about a movie like that?
Like with your parents? I don't know if I'd be brave enough in your situation. Does that help?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be brave enough if that situation is autobiographical. I don't know if I'd be brave enough, and maybe that's the wrong word, to talk about that movie, to start some conversations from new perspectives on myself and on them. Yeah, I could. But whether I'd say, you know, if that was an autobiographical thing, I wouldn't, I guess, say, hey, go see that movie and then let's talk about it. Because the first reading on that movie is a condemnation on the father. And by saying the first reading, it's I'm implying that there are some other readings to make too. Some other depths, other things going on in that movie that we should read too. And I think maybe now's a good time to mention it, that the first name of the movie was Tiger. The Tiger. And that was titled, was about the old man, the Tiger. And the guy wrote the movie, wrote the play, saw it produced, changed its name to I Never Sang for My Father. Now there's a real big difference in the title, the Tiger, which is sort of a implied condemnation of the father, and I Never Sang for My Father. And I think, in a sense, the guy wrote the movie, wrote the play, and then found out what he wrote later. Maybe he thought of the title first, wrote the play, and then he found out what he wrote and had to change the title to I Never Sang for My Father, which is a whole different ballgame.
That's kind of like a condemnation of the son, then, right? That seems to be more of a condemnation of the son.
I don't think it's a... That's where it's... It's... No, not of an ungratefulness, I don't think. And I don't know if it would work in the same... quite in the same way. I think I Never Sang for My Father comes along as a... as a... as a recognition. That's a great image. That's a great image. I never bloomed for my father. That is really good.
I can remember seeing this film about a year and a half ago here. Since then I've been home. One of the things that I did mention about being here was this film that I saw to my parents. And I feel in our relationship with my parents I can talk to them about anything. And of course, the conversation, I got to talk to my father about the film. And in terms of my father and my grandfather, which is my father's father, so it's three generations right there. And something of this sort is happening in our family. I mean, it's not the same thing, it's senility, it's more what's happening. And very interesting just being able to sit down and, you know, we've done this before, talking about the problem. That's never been a problem. The problem is trying to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's never to approach it. And for me, I appreciate that my parents, that I can sit down and discuss the problem about our relationships and our feelings towards each other in growth and change.
Something, a note in there, is it sure helps to have three generations.
Yeah.
It sure helps to have your parents, have your grandparents around, and to see that your parents have certain problems with your grandparents, and to get to face that with them and their parents.
I can say, Dad, I don't want me to be like you are and how you're treated and how I want to treat you.
And that's a
right.
Something that as long as like this, you know, the other side to miracle drugs, you know, kind of thing. And also getting in many, I don't know if where we're coming from, where from the most of us being, you know, Svensk or Norsk or Dansk or something like that, it's quite as much, but But in over the population as a whole, you have two generations. Now this the parents are dealing with the grandparents right there, while the children are there to talk about some things. It'd be hard. I think it might be a little easier too if the grandchildren could talk to the grandparents. Lots of times I know that in certain studies that I've read about that it's the children. Children and the grandparents seem to have more open conversations about many things.
I can talk more to my grandfather about some things than my father can.
Yeah.
Because I am once removed from.
Mm-hmm. And you can talk, and then with your father, you can talk about certain things to sort of prepare yourself too, in many ways. And now, with a two-generational situation, and with the mobility that we have, there's some real. You know, where does one learn to do anything else? You know, okay, we get outside of, you know, there's some good things about natural man too that are built in. But you get rid of the generations, you get rid of Christ, and you've got some real difficult situations.
Just one thing I want to mention. You keep referring to Christ and to no hope and stuff like that. Well, my family, Christ has never been mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
We are still striving towards hope.
Mm-hmm. And there's one of the great things about living one of the scary things too, because you could feel like you could do without Christ very easily, but is that in Western civilization, it's been shaped on, you know, Hebraic and Christian traditions. An awful lot sticks, you know, that one isn't consciously aware of. An awful lot of the view of those worlds sticks in forms and in traditions that aren't specifically Christian or say confessing church, and yet a lot of the quote wisdom of the tradition does stick in tradition, and so that can make a difference too. But I think Dave's question about the condemnation of the son. I'll say something about when I went to the movie, I was angry at the son when I saw the movie. And I was angry at myself when I saw the movie. I didn't see, I guess in a sense, I didn't see anything new to get angry about my father about, but I saw some really new things to get angry about myself about. And that title just knocked the wind right out of my sails. Just knocked the wind right out of my sails. And I guess I have to admit that, because I don't think that, apparently that, from some conversations I've had, that it wasn't the reading that people got on the first time. That's something that I got. And maybe it's just because I was really nasty. Well, I could demand that my father be proud of me and never think that I haven't ever told my father I was proud of him. That I could, for years, scrutinize, actually, I was a very precocious child, scrutinize that when I was two and told my father I hated him because he wasn't Christ, and I wasn't just joking. I'd thought about this for quite a while. And then, and I left him then with that. Which is a frightening sort of thing when your kid at two comes up with a statement like that, and you say, "No, come on, be a kid, come on, a few more years, you know, don't do this to me," you know. That's kind of like an up against the wall, Dad, you know, at two, okay. And to have figured out, you know, about in the third grade what my mom was, and not have changed that idea until I was in my 20s. But that's another story. But to be watching with the what we talked about today, the internier, parliamentary spirit, would be very... I was a nice kid. You know, a really nice kid. But, click, 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 going on in my head all the time. And it wasn't all that was happening. You know, I was an incredibly devoted son at the same time. Not at the same time, at half the time. And the other half of the time, I was, you know, whetting my knives, you know. And it was a really bad thing. And to... a judgmentalism that I put, and a measuring my parents against an ideal that I made when I was between 1 and 7. You know, I came up with a scale to measure my parents when I was young, and then blamed them for 15 years for not being up, living up to an ideal that I had of them.
Well, maybe they gave it to you. And then didn't live up to it.
Okay, maybe they did. I asked that question. I realized they didn't. You know, in my case, they didn't. Now, that's why one of the reasons, though, I asked the question, how hard is it unconsciously to let go of that image that a child does have? Because it's an incredible image. I can get readings from it, like from Lucy and Sam right now. They're building up this thing. And, I thought in my own case it was in certain senses their own respect for each other built that understanding in me, just in the sense that mom thought dad was this and I thought mom was this, so I thought dad was this. Dad thought mom was this and I thought dad was this, so I thought mom was this, and which just, you know, just help support this huge thing I had of them. But it was mainly, I think, what I had of them. And I don't think it's just I don't think it's something like I should condemn me, like it's something like Dave was using that word on the sun, so much to condemn me for that starting, but to be so dense as to let it go so long. You know, I wish somebody had given me some new insights into myself so that I could see that I had created an image and blame my parents for not living up to the image I had of them. And ironically, if hating, only hating the image, you know. But I do see that parents can fear talking too much to break that image, and I can see some parents building that image and thinking that that's the important thing to do. You know? The human community is built on the strengths of its members. And for a family, that you can think that the only way for the son to grow up right is to think that his father is the strongest thing in, you know, on the block. That is a natural, that is a scary, scary thing. The divine community is built on the weakness of its members. You know, but I think that somehow I've got to, you know, if I want my child to grow up right, I've got to be strong, always strong, and never to admit weakness, and never cry. And if there's any German blood in the house, you know about this. No tears. Tough. We're tough, and we won't, and we won't give an inch. And then the difficulty then where you can actually not be able to, people can live a whole lifetime and not be able to cry, allow themselves to. That's horrible, I think. And I know in my family someone who's experienced that. Not me. I'm a soggy old face. So, Sig, is there any more on that? There's more on that, I think, for my... I mean, why I responded that way, but...
I really wasn't asking so much for a personal confession of how you saw the sun in the movie. What ways he demonstrated that.
Okay, just in one. He zinged his father about 6 times in the first 5 minutes of the movie. Zinged him. I mean... Well, his father, with an honest "hello, great to see you," met what you would, 6 parlamentary or 5 or 6 parliamentary type comments. Dad, you don't have to do that. Dad, no. Dad, no. Dad,
if
no.
He's already done it before. I mean, he's gone through this lifestyle again and again and again. And his dad just hits him with it again. What's going to be his reply?
The answer is outside of Christ, inside of Christ. Big deal. But but right away, the father came in, and being partly senile, his mind was like a sieve. I mean, that's how we start the movie. He had forgotten that the son had written, not because he's an ungrateful guy, but, and that. He's 80 years old, and he's losing some of it. And he's very happy to see him. And then, right away, "Well, I wrote you. Why didn't you remember? Well, I wrote you." And a series of comments like that. I think in terms of Turnier's parliamentary spirit, the sun, you can run down the sun right through the whole thing, almost. And either he zings back or he makes a face. Oh my God, there he goes again.
At what point do you sacrifice your own goals, your ideals, your own life, your own thoughts, even to a senile old man who's laying in a bed and can't say anything to you? My grandfather was sitting there, he had a stroke. He couldn't even talk.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I would tell him, "Gramps, I'm going to do this." And he'd sit there in his hand and he'd just shake out this thing and says, "No, I don't think you should do that."
Yeah.
And I'd go through the roof and I'd still feel like that. At what point do you sacrifice your ideals? At what point do you say, "Oh, that's all right. I'll just go along with everything he says.
Mm-hmm.
I'll sit and watch TV with him. I'll watch his westerns forever. Mm-hmm. I'll stay with him. He wants me to come over 3 times a week and say nothing. I'll come over 3 times a week." At what point do you fight back?
I think that you don't have to fight back. You can change some subjects. I think it isn't so much that you're the point. But there, we're going to have to, in order
I'm
to say that.
At what point is you, what point are you the point?
Okay, I'd say something here. I'm going to have a heck of a time answering that question outside of what I say Christ has for me, the gospel has for me. And I, as a lifestyler, know my vision of the world outside of Christ is a lot worse than most people's living in the world outside of Christ. I think if, outside of Christ, okay, the two bears fight each other, as it says in the introduction of this thing, until one knocks, the young bear knocks the old bear off the cliff. But I don't see fighting it isn't the point. Again, here's getting Christ into it. Mercy's the point. And with a little imagination, I think we can do some things where there are other alternatives. There are alternatives to watching the cowboy show and going home with a shrug of disgust, you know. There are alternatives. He didn't, to be a man, actually the one of leaving the room was not particularly the mature thing to do, and neither would sitting down and watching the TV show. To talk about something that wasn't going to scare the father and talk about something that the father might want to talk about is a start. I think one problem is that we expect what we do to pay off right now, and if it doesn't, we don't do it. That's maybe the thing to talk about would be about how he got his mayorship in the first place. To start conversation on some in some different areas. To get the subject around to something that the father is proud of. That might help. And in terms of the grandfather, I don't need the particular case, I don't know. I don't
That's very easy to say.
Everything inside tells you to punch it, you know, to okay, this is it. We've got to, you know.
No, I'm saying it's easy to just say, you know, well, I'm going to talk about something that doesn't upset him.
It's a lot easier to say than do, that's for sure.
Man, what about you can't do that. You just go, well, you know, Gramps, I think that's great. But, you know, and say something that leads into this, and there you go again.
Let me sneak one in on here. Just to sneak one, a word in here. Resolution. Okay. Put a question mark whether resolution, you know, what we want to do is resolve the problem. We want to get the grandfather on our side. We want the father on our side. The father wants us on his side. Just because the father wants me on his side doesn't mean that I should not, you know, either walk out or try to yank the father on my side. Resolution is a word. Resolution is a word that may come from the devil. Okay, what's that?
I think we're forgetting too that in their situation there were particular problems that had to be dealt with. Primarily, he wanted to get married and go to California.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, that's going to have to be dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, by talking about the mayorship and everything, great. But finally, mm-hmm. the sticky problems are going to have to mm-hmm. be dealt with too.
Yeah.
But within the first 24 hours, he's home before.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about California. It was in the car.
Yeah.
Like pink.
That's right.
Now I want to tell you. It's sort of like, you know, okay, something that I could see happening in the thing is preparing a text. You know, it's almost, you know, I've said this to lifestyle guys before. It's almost a sin to hit somebody with a prepared text. It's like, okay, now, I'm going to sit here. I have a problem with, say, difficulty with my wife. All right, I sit down. I say, okay, here, I think out all this thing that I'm going to tell her. You know, it's this whole thing, you know, this whole business. And then while she's cooking something the next day, her mind's in a completely another place. Maybe she's just feeling great. She's forgotten all about that argument 2 weeks ago, and ever since I've been preparing the text. She's doing something, and then I walk in there, you know, and she says, my gosh, you've been thinking about this all this time. You know, you hate me. You know, and where did this come from? What are you doing? There's nothing that lies more about your situation while you're trying to tell the truth than the prepared text you hit somebody with, you know, after a long time of absence. Now, in a sense, he's sitting there, I'm going to have to talk about my folks about this thing, and now I'm going to tell them this, and everything is going to work out this way, and this way, and this way, and this way, and right away he's disappointed. Bing. Right off the bat. And then it's just this all thing, and then who gets blamed for the disappointment? You know. It doesn't have anything to do with this, you know, that I screwed up by preparing this text and writing a script for my father and mother. To, you know, I write a play for them, and they're supposed to give these lines. They don't, and I blame them. Now that's where this movie goes way outside this movie, doesn't it? Because how often do you write scripts for people, and you write lines, And then when they don't live up to the lines, you blame them with all the self-righteousness you know, possible. You see? You know, and I've, oh boy, classrooms, teachers can do that, or can write, I'm going to do this kind of presentation, and then so-and-so is going to ask this and this and this. Sure. You know, you walk in, it doesn't happen, you get all, you blow up. But specifically in relationships with people that you care about and you have deep relationships for, you plan things out, and it's just really dangerous. And particularly in, maybe it's only men and fathers and sons, or I don't think so, but let's just see it in male authoritarian roles. Particularly that's dangerous. You're going to tell your boss, you know, and then you hit him, and the guy says, huh? Oh, you're fired. You know, something like that. They won't know where it's coming from. They won't know where it's coming from. He's managed in all these letters to write not to say anything specific, and now he's going to hit him in the car. When he really does know that this difficulty, and one of the funny things that he does know too is that it may kill his mother. That the son does know that the mother has lived for him. He does know that. That doesn't make it any easier for the father. By the way, you know, that doesn't make the situation any easier for the father.
But the mother herself said, why can't you say that it would kill him?
Two, yeah.
That it's almost like she was part of the strength of him, and that it didn't break her up that much to know what her son was going to do.
Yeah.
But it was his, it was the father's.
Yeah.
Was
going
to get broken up. But two, Gene did make an attempt to have a conversation. He did turn down the TV.
Yeah.
He made that act.
Mm-hmm.
And although he had, you know, again, prepared text, he did try to turn down the TV so that they could talk.
Mm-hmm.
And his father turned it back up again.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It was like, you do what I want to do or else we won't do anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Father saying, you know, we're going to watch TV.